Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, Champaign's exclusive Subaru dealer, on Route 45 in Savoy. Online at wardenmartin.com. The phone number is 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy.
There's still time to win one of two grand prizes in the WILL sweepstakes, the $2,000 grand prize shopping spree plus design services from Carter's Furniture, or the $2,000 garden grand prize from Country Arbors. Or you could bring home a shaker-style dining table from Schweitzer & Schweitzer, a genome embroidery machine from So Sassy, or artwork from Billy Morrow and C.D. Mariah Jackson. But you can't win if you don't enter, and entries must be postmarked by September 6th. To request an entry form, call 217-333-1070.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, on the AM radio dial at 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Here's an observation from pediatrician Dr. Mel Levine. Every child needs to be wanted. It comes from the foreword to Richard Lavoie's book, It's So Much Work to Be Your Friend, Helping the Child with Learning Disabilities Find Social Success. Some kids have no problem winning acceptance. For others, it's not so easy. Richard Lavoie is our guest this afternoon. He has 30 years of experience in the field of special education. We'll talk with him about how to help children form supportive connections with peers and adults. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Maybe you have an experience to share. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, feel free to use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Richard Lavoie. He has been a teacher, then headmaster at residential special education facilities. He has also served as an adjunct professor or visiting lecturer at the university level. It's So Much Work to Be Your Friend is published by Touchstone, a division of Simon & Schuster. There's also a companion video and DVD available from PBS. And you can find our guest, Richard Lavoie, online at ricklavoie.com. His last name spelled L-A-V-O-I-E, ricklavoie.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Rick Lavoie, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Sure. Academic success is important for kids and their parents, but so is social success. You say kids with learning disorders face a double whammy here. They can be frustrated on both fronts. What does that frustration mean for a child?
Well, it can be tremendously significant, not only for the child, but frankly for the family. Starting with the family first, whenever I deal with a family of five, including my own, I try to keep this analogy in mind, that a family of five is like five people lying side by side on a waterbed. Whenever one person moves, everyone feels the ripple. And that's the way it is for a family who has a special needs child, that the child's rejection and isolation by the neighborhood kids and by the kids at school can have an impact on the entire family. But what's probably most important is the impact it has on the child, because if you think about it, childhood friendships a sort of a social laboratory for us. It's where we learn how to share and how to give and take and win and lose gracefully. And there's so much we learn in childhood friendships. And if the child doesn't have those relationships, then he's lost that laboratory and ends up being an adult or a later adolescent without those social skills. So it really has a tremendous impact on the kids.
Yeah, and those social skills give us the social support network.
Absolutely, and particularly in adolescence, because as you well know, the adolescent doesn't particularly care what mom or dad think or what the teachers think. What's really important is what the peers think. So these kids come in, our kids come into adolescence without that peer support. In fact, they're often isolated and rejected, actively rejected by the peers. So it can be extraordinarily difficult. And although we need to, I mean, I'm an educator and my heart and soul is in the classroom and we need to focus on education, the reality is that most kids spend about 1,000 hours a year in the classroom, which is less than 20% of their waking time. The 80% of the time that they spend is spent at Little League practice and Boy Scout meetings and church meetings and in the neighborhood and in the hallways at school. And that's really where our kids are losing the battle.
Yeah. Another interviewer once asked you, if you could give America's parents one message, what would it be? I got two questions here. What was your answer, and why did you answer the way you did?
My answer was, if we could understand, it was sort of a curveball question, but I've stood by my answer. If we could understand that children go to school for a living, that's their job. They do it 6 or 7 hours a day, and that's their, not only is it their job, it's their identity. You know, if you're in your neighborhood, Celeste, and you bump into a 13-year-old kid you haven't seen for a while, the first thing you're likely to say to him is, "Hello, Billy, how's school?" We identify kids so closely with what they do in school, even though you might run into Billy's dad and be with him for a half hour before you'd think to ask him how things are going at work. So it is how they make their living. It's what they do 6 or 7 hours a day. And if you had a job 6 or 7 hours a day where you were rejected by the people who you worked with and rejected by the people you worked for, you'd be extraordinarily unhappy as well. So we shouldn't be surprised that we do begin to see emotional problems develop in these kids who don't have any friendships.
Yeah. When and how did you begin to see the connection, the link between learning disorders and social incompetence?
Well, I had a very interesting laboratory for that, in that, you see, for years, the field knew, we knew as professionals and particularly as parents, that our kids were rejected and isolated by other kids. But we thought it was indirectly linked to the learning problem. But we thought the child had a learning problem, therefore he failed in school. Because he failed in school, he didn't have any friends. So I always worked in schools, special ed facilities, who took kids out of that environment and made them successful in school, where suddenly the curriculum was designed around them. Well, if that logic is true, that it was the school failure that caused the relationship problems, then their relationship problems should have gone away once they were in a successful school environment. But what we found was, even though they were being successful in school, they still couldn't make friends. So we realize now that it's a very direct link between the learning disability and the social skill problem. The child who can't memorize the times tables is also going to have difficulty remembering that grandpa doesn't like you to hang around in his garden when you go to visit. And the child who has difficulty sequencing in math will also have difficulty sequencing the instructions at soccer practice. So we realize now that it's a very, very direct link. And I learned that from working in residential schools and realizing that even if the child was successful in school, they had tremendous difficulty making friends.
Mm. How many children encounter learning problems in school?
It's almost embarrassing to say that although the field is 35 or 40 years old now, we still haven't decided on a definition. The definition in Wisconsin is different from the definition in Indiana, and those two definitions are different than the definition in Illinois. So when you talk about prevalence, you really have to look at how they're defining it. But the best number that I've been able to come up with is about 10%. About 10% of our kids have learning problems that are severe enough that they impact on their ability to function.
How well are our schools dealing with the problem?
It's frankly, and I have a wide window on that because I do nothing but speak and consult and have been spoken in pretty much every state in the last 4 or 5 years. It's sort of one step forward, two steps back. I think that we begin to make progress and then it begins to fall back a little bit as budgets get cut. And there still is a great deal of very deep feeling out there in many schools that putting special needs kids into regular ed, which is the mandate of the federal law, putting special needs kids into regular ed will in some way negatively impact on regular ed. And even though there's no research to back that up, we still find a great deal of resistance in schools. So in direct answer to your question, mm-hmm. We're not doing terribly well out there, frankly.
Yeah. How are we doing at teaching social skills?
Well, schools are just now beginning to realize that it's in their best interest to teach social skills. For years, this is one area, frankly, where parents have been way ahead of the curve, way ahead of us as professionals, by saying that we had to do something about social skills. But for many years, schools said, that's not our job. Our job is to teach the kids how to read, write, and spell, and it isn't our job. It's not within our purview to help with social skills. But what we now schools realize is the child's not going to learn anyway if he doesn't have friends, if he doesn't have connections, and if he's being actively isolated and rejected by the other kids, he's not going to learn anyway. So it's in the school's best interest to help him develop these social skills so he'll be more receptive to learning. So schools are beginning to get on track with it, but it's been a long way, and I think we have a long way to go.
Yeah. What is your opinion of the effort to, quote, mainstream?
Well, mainstreaming, I think, when it's done appropriately, I think it's a really good idea. I have championed this idea for 30 years. I see many schools who are doing it too fast. They're doing it without a lot of forethought. And I also see many, as I said earlier, many schools where teachers are being extraordinarily resistant to bringing these kids into regular ed. And, in fact, I was dealing with an audience in California last week, and a group of teachers who, frankly, were very resistant to bringing special needs kids into the class with the feeling that they would pull regular ed down in some way. And I told them a very quick New England story about a group of children waiting to get into a school at 8 o'clock in the morning, one morning, and they're waiting to enter the school, but there'd been a surprise snowstorm the night before, and the steps were all covered with snow, and the kids couldn't get in, so the janitor was out shoveling off the steps. And one of the little boys was in a wheelchair, and he said to the janitor, could you please shovel off the ramp so I can get in? And the janitor got a little bit miffed, and he said, well, look, there are 10 other kids waiting to use the steps. Let me get the steps shoveled off, and I'll shovel off the ramp then, but you'll have to wait. And the little boy said, but if you shovel off the ramp, we can all get in. In other words, if you make this place accessible to me, you've made it accessible to everybody. And I think that's the drum that I keep beating with teachers, that working with these kids really makes you a better teacher. And I find teachers more and more responsive to that. And very frankly, in your area of Indiana and Illinois, Wisconsin, I find them particularly responsive to saying, okay, these kids are going to be in our class. It's a federal mandate they be in our class. And so let's learn how to work with them effectively. And what the teachers find is when they learn some of these little special ed techniques and tricks that they can use, those techniques not only work with the special needs kid, they also work with their best and brightest kid when he just doesn't particularly understand a concept. You can kind of pull out a special ed trick and use that with the child. So things are looking better, but like I said, we've got a long way to go.
Yeah. Richard Lavoie is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of It's So Much Work to Be Your Friend, Helping the Child with Learning Disabilities Find Social Success. We're talking this afternoon about how to help kids form supportive connections with peers and adults. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. So where do we begin to understand the difficulties some children have in social situations?
I think we first have to realize it's not their fault, there's tremendous discrepancy and disagreement, as I'm sure you know, in the field of psychology. You know, Freud doesn't agree with Jung. Nobody agrees with Adler. There's all, you know, the field of psychology is really splintered. But the one thing that every field of psychology agrees with is that the number one need of human beings is to be liked and accepted by other human beings. That's our primary need as a human being, to be liked by others. So if a kid is doing something that makes other kids dislike him, we can automatically assume he doesn't mean to do it. I mean, why would he purposely violate one of his primary needs? So if you accept that premise, that the kids that make these social mistakes don't mean to do it, the first thing we need to do is take punishment off the table. Yeah, I mean, punishing a child for making a social mistake would be like punishing a child for having the flu or for needing glasses. It's beyond his control. So the first thing we need to do is take punishment off the table and realize that doesn't work, and then begin to look at some techniques that do.
Okay. Let's talk with a listener now, a caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi, I have a question. I have been fortunate enough to see the actual video of this program, and I'm with the local, the Champaign-Urbana Autism Network. And my question to your guest is, have you ever specifically present in your presentations talked about autism, maybe specifically Asperger's kids? Because I think this would really, it really hits the nail on the head for our kids that are higher functioning autistic and are having problems with that social issue. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the comment, and I agree completely. I've been working, for instance, in the book I talk extensively about what are called social skill autopsies, where basically when a child makes a social skill error, instead of punishing the child for it, take the error, lay it on the table, and with the child in a very supportive way, do an autopsy on it. Open it up and say, okay, here's what you said when the teacher aide came in. You said, oh, you got your hair cut over the weekend. How long will it take to grow back? Well, you didn't mean to offend the person, but you did. So let's look at some of the things you could have done. And the social skill autopsy approach that we've used for kids with learning disabilities for a long time is tailor-made for the Asperger's child, children with high-functioning autism, particularly Asperger's, respond very, very well to the techniques we've been using for a while with kids with learning problems. It's a great challenge that parents face of children with, particularly with Asperger's, because these kids are often very bright, they're very talented in specific areas, and they're very normal-looking, in many cases embarrassingly attractive kids, and yet they have tremendous difficulty with social skills. And what we're finding is so many of the techniques that we recommend work very effectively with those kids, and candidly, many of the techniques that I designed 30 years ago were with kids who had Asperger's. We didn't know what it was then. I'm sure the caller will agree that Asperger's has really come to the fore in the last 5 or 6 years. There have always been kids with that syndrome, but we never really knew what it was.
Hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what it is?
Well, it's a high functioning autism area, and these kids have very difficult time investing in other people, dealing with social skills, interacting with other people, and they have a fascinating part of their makeup, which is what's called magical thinking, which sounds like a small thing, but it has great impact. And what that means basically is they think that you know everything that they know. And again, I'm sure the caller will agree, as a mom of one of these kids, it can really complicate their social life. There's an experiment you can do with kids with Asperger's. I've done it with many kids, where I have in my office a box of Band-Aids, and it's a Band-Aid box. You'd recognize it from 30 feet away. It's that metal Band-Aid, blue and white Band-Aid box, and it's filled with candy. And I'll show it to a child with Asperger's, and I'll say, what do you think is in this box? And the child naturally responds, Band-Aids. I open it up and show them that there's candy in it. And I say, well, okay, now I'm going to take this box downstairs and show the teachers in the teacher's lounge and ask them what's in it. What do you think they'll say? The Asperger's kid invariably says, candy. Because he knows it's candy, and he assumes that everyone does. Well, that's only one small aspect of Asperger's, but if you think about it, it has a tremendous impact on their social skills. Where I would be walking across the campus of our school, and one of the children with Asperger's would come up to me and say, Mr. Lavoie, Tuesday or Thursday? And I, what do you think? Because what had happened is he would see me coming across campus. He would think to himself, I wonder if we're going bowling on Tuesday or Thursday. He would go up to me. By the time he reached me, he assumed that I knew that he was thinking about bowling. And so he just would say, Tuesday or Thursday. Now, again, that seems like a very minor problem, and it's only the tip of the iceberg for kids with Asperger's. But you can imagine the social skill difficulties that this kid has. Because whenever he interacts with peers or teachers or even with his family, he's making these false assumptions all the time. So it's a very, very complex disorder. And to give a little comfort to that mom, it's difficult raising a child with Asperger's, but imagine a generation ago when nobody knew what it was. Yeah. Nobody had any idea what it was.
Yeah. Well, how did you handle that situation Tuesday or Thursday?
Well, now I understand. You know, again, before we understood that, I would say to the child, I have no idea what you're talking about. Now I would tend to say, Keith, you know, I need a little bit more context there. I'm not exactly sure what you're talking about. But again, you begin to realize that these social skill problems are not the fault of the child, that it's just the way that they, what they bring to the table. It's the way they happen to be.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the social skill autopsy a little bit further, about what it is and how it works and the stages, the five basic and separate stages of the autopsy.
Well, the autopsy, a quick history on that, the way that developed was my wife and I, 25 years ago, were having dinner with another couple, and they had a daughter who attended our special ed school, and she was a great kid but had tremendous social skill difficulties. And we were sitting at the table having dinner, the five of us, at their home, the other couple and Janet and me and the little girl. And the little girl said something very inappropriate. I forget what it was, but it was really inappropriate to say at the table. And the father yelled at her and sent her up to her room. And we sat there for a while, as you can imagine, a rather uncomfortable social situation. And the father knew me pretty well, and he turned to me and he said, "You know, Rick, I know I made a mistake. I shouldn't have done that. I could tell you by your body language I blew it. What should I have done?" And I said to him, "You know, you're great with her. You're terrific with your daughter. And if you were working on the five times tables with her, and she said that 5 times 3 was 10, you wouldn't have sent her to a room, would you?" "No, I wouldn't." "What would you have done?" "Well, I would have taught her what the right answer was so she wouldn't make that same mistake again." That's what you need to do with social skills. And that's what the autopsy is. When a child makes a social skill error, you basically sit down with the kid, lay the error out on the table, open it up and say, "Okay, what went wrong here? What mistake did you make?" And very, as it says in the book, outlines in the book, you never use the word "should." You don't say, "This is what you should have done," but rather you say, "This is what you could have done." Again, when you commented on the teacher aide's haircut, that you didn't like her haircut, there are a number of other things you could have said, Sally. You could have commented on her sweater. You could have commented on the weather. You could have said nothing. There were a number of things you could have done. And continually giving the child the idea that he or she has social options, have different ways that they can deal with a social problem. And we've been doing social skill autopsies now for 25 years with kids, and they are really very, very successful, more successful, frankly, than what many programs do, which is this formal social skill workshops where they bring a group of kids who all have poor social skills together and try to teach them social skills. Those tend to not be very effective because our kids need to learn in a natural environment, and they're going to learn better from things that have really happened to them. I was speaking to a parent the other day, and she said, "I want to teach my child how to eat in a restaurant." I said, "Well, then take him to a restaurant. You know, take him to the real site, to the scene of the crime, if you will. And you want to teach him how to stand in line? Take him to the bank and have him stand in line with you." Our kids need to learn in those sort of natural settings, and that's what the autopsy is all about.
Yeah, and thinking back to the multiplication question, you know, 3 times 5 is not 10, it's 15, what equation I gave there, 3 times 5 is 15. You've got to practice. It's got to, you know, you don't remember those things right from the get-go. Usually you have to do it a few times. You got to do it over and over again.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And I think that the ideal setting, and I had an ideal laboratory in that I ran residential schools, and so we taught everyone on the staff, the kitchen people, the maintenance people, the bus drivers, the secretaries, so everybody knew how to do autopsies. So when a child made a social error, there was an adult who, again, and they're not considered punishments. It got to the point, Celeste, that kids would come into my office and say, "I had an argument with my sister on the phone last night. She called from college and we had a big fight, and I don't know what I did wrong. Will you autopsy it with me? Will you do an autopsy with me?" They would actually ask you to autopsy because they didn't view them as scoldings or negatives. And so, but if you can teach the babysitter how to do the autopsies, the older brothers and sisters, grandma and grandpa, so when a child makes a social skill error, instead of being scolded for it or punished, somebody sits down and says, "Okay, here's what happened. Let's lay it out on the table. Let's open it up. Let's take everything out and say, what did we learn here? What could you have done?" The surprising thing about this, and it's difficult to believe unless you've done it, is how quickly the kids got on board with that because they want to improve their social skills. They want to have friends. And so they very quickly jump on board. The sad thing is for these kids, frankly, is many of them don't even know what a friend is. I remember interviewing a little boy one day, and for the school, and I asked him if he had any friends in class, and he said, "Oh, I've got 10 friends in my class. There are 10 kids in my class who are my friends." And I looked over his shoulder at his mother, and his mother shaking her head, "No, he doesn't." So I said, "Well, name your friends," and he named these kids. And I said, "Well, what makes them your friends?" And he said, "The other kids who don't pick on me," which is really kind of sad. He's divided the world into two kinds of kids, the kids who pick on him and the kids who are his friends. Now, those kids he listed as friends, they weren't really friends. They never called him. They never invited him. They never played with him. But by virtue of the fact they didn't pick on him, he considered them his friends, which is that's a pretty sad place for an 8-year-old kid to be.
Yeah. I remember once a mother telling me, and she started crying when she told me this, that her daughter had just received her first invitation to a birthday party, and she was 6 years old.
Yeah. It's the kind of pain, I think I say in the introduction of the book, that in my career, again, I've been doing this for 3 decades now, and probably 50 times in my career, a parent has sat at my desk and put his or her head down on my desk and just sobbed about their kid. And not once was that parent crying because the kid couldn't read or write or spell. When a parent's reduced to that kind of pain, it's about the social isolation and social rejection our kids suffer every day. And it's extraordinarily painful. Particularly, I mean, imagine going to work every day or being at home every day, knowing that at that moment your child is at school being bullied and picked on by other kids. It's a type of pain that unless you've experienced it as a parent, it's very difficult to understand.
Mm. What do you do about a bully, whether it's your child or someone else's child?
Well, bullying, of course, has become a huge issue in our field, in the field of education, and there's a lot in the book about that because I think we absolutely need to give up viewing bullying as a rite of passage. Sticks and stones will break my bones. Those days are gone. The National Education Association estimates that 300,000 American school kids stay home from school every day because they're being bullied at school, which is just, you know, if there was a childhood disease that had 300,000 kids staying out of school every day, we'd do something about it. What brought it into focus, frankly, is Columbine. That those kids and, frankly, every child who's been charged with major school violence has been a kid who was bullied. And then, you know, if I was a kid, I was being bullied, I could get my older brother to go push the kid around. Now you can go home and get an automatic weapon and bring it to school. And that's what's happening. And so there's a lot we can do in schools. Some of the things that we've worked on with schools before is some sort of school-wide anti-bullying policy where you put a box in front of the front of the principal's office. And if anyone in the community, anyone in the school community, bus driver, teacher, kid, anybody knows of a situation where a child's being bullied, they write it down on a slip of paper and put it in the principal's box, and the principal deals with it. So then if Johnny is called in for bullying Michael, Johnny doesn't know if it was Michael who turned him in or the cafeteria lady who turned him in, and so he's not very likely to go out and strike out against Michael because he doesn't know who turned him in. Those kind of strategies, there's other strategies we've used that have been used in schools. One school, in fact, it was in your area, is having a tremendous difficulty with physical bullying, and frankly, most bullying is not physical, it's more verbal, but with physical bullying, and the principal came out and said, "The reason one child will beat up another is to entertain the audience, kids standing around." And the principal came out and said, "If any teacher or administrator comes upon a situation where two kids are fighting and there are a group of kids standing around watching, everyone gets suspended. Not just the kids fighting, but the kids who are watching, too." So then what happened in that school is if one kid would begin to push another kid around, the audience, the other kids would say, "I'm out of here because I don't need to get thrown out of school by standing here if this turns into a fight." So there are some very creative things you can do to deal with bullying, but we really need to. The days, again, of looking at it as a rite of passage are just gone.
Yeah. Well, hopefully those kids that vamoosed would go and tell somebody, "Hey, there's a fight down the hall." or does just the audience going away kind of take the wind out of the sails of the bully?
Well, it does take the wind out of the sails of the bully. You're absolutely right. But I think that there were three real victims in a bullying situation. The victim, who's obviously the victim. The bystander, the kid who stands by and watches, who feels very guilty and very powerless about his or her ability to stop this. Mm-hmm. And candidly, the one who pays the worst price in the end is the bully. because they begin to develop a sense of power that they don't really have. And as children, they feel almost invincible because they're able to bully other kids, and they find out that when they become an adult, that skill doesn't get them very far. So really, the reason we need to deal with bullying is that all three of the players in that drama are being negatively affected.
We're talking this afternoon about how to help children form supportive connections with peers and adults. Our guest this afternoon is Richard Lavoie. He is the author of It's So Much Work to Be Your Friend, Helping the Child with Learning Disabilities Find Social Success. You can join us this afternoon, listeners, with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling with a comment about teachers and why I personally think they would be resistant to mainstreaming and similar programs to get the kids in the classroom. A lot of times they've gone through their own training to train regular children, and no doubt special needs children have special needs. And over the past 10 years, there's been significant cuts in educational funding where many people have been asked to do multiple jobs. And I would believe that a lot of the teachers would feel that even if an assistant or a special needs teacher is assigned to students in the classroom, eventually that responsibility would be put on the teacher, and they would be responsible with no pay increase and no incentive to gain that responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like going back to the janitor example. You know, all your life you've been shoveling steps, and you know how to shovel steps, and you have no idea how to shovel a ramp.
Right. Yeah, and you know, you and I are in much more in agreement than you might think. And you made three extraordinarily good points. Let me elucidate on them if I could, Celeste. First of all, I couldn't agree more. Schools are being asked to do more than they've ever been asked to do before. Our society is crumbling around us, and many of the institutions that were so important in your upbringing and mine simply don't exist anymore. And every time one of those institutions falls by the wayside, society turns to us, the school, the only institution that's still standing, and says, well, then you do what they used to do. Anecdotally, there's a school system on Cape Cod, where I live, that 25 years ago started a free lunch program for kids in lower socioeconomic groupings. If you couldn't afford lunch, the school would buy you lunch. Well, everybody does that now. 10 years ago, they started a free breakfast program where these kids can come in and get breakfast before they went to class. And last year, they started a free supper program where these kids can stop by the cafeteria on the way to the bus at the end of the day and pick up a, you know, styrofoam dish filled with macaroni and cheese or ravioli, what is left over from lunch. I mean, you know, which I think is a wonderful thing the school is doing. But when I was a kid, if there was a family in my community in that kind of trouble, the neighbors helped out, or the Red Cross helped out, or the church helped out. It wasn't the school expected to do that. So I couldn't agree more with the caller that we're being asked to do more than we've ever been asked to do before. But my bias, and I'll state it as a bias because I'm a special educator, I think the greatest challenge that this generation of teachers faces is what we do about the mainstream, about the special needs child. Because, and I believe that when we're long gone a generation from now, the generation of teachers after us will look at us posthumously, if you will, and say, what did you do about learning disabled kids? Because we're the first generation of teachers who knew what this was. The teachers that I had in school, I'm in my mid-50s, the teachers I had in school had no idea what this was. And I understand and empathize with the caller completely. I know it's tough. I know it's difficult. I know we don't have adequate training and we need to do that. But the reality is that these kids, by federal mandate, are in our classes. And I was speaking at a school system where there was a great deal of resistance by the teachers, and one of the teachers stood up and said, I don't want these kids in my class. I don't want them in my class. And he turned to the director of special ed and he said, if you put them in my class, I'm going to treat them terribly. They're going to go home and make their parents' lives miserable, and the parents are going to call you and make your life miserable. So don't give me any of those kids. And, of course, I'm a consultant. You know, the special ed director looks at me, you know, say something, you know, to do something here. And I said, you know, let me just get this straight, sir. I said, are you saying you will not deal, 7% of the kids in the school district have learning disabilities, and you're saying you won't deal with that 7% of the kids? And he said, that's right. And I said, do you understand, again, that 7% of the kids in this district have LD, and you're saying at a public forum you won't deal with those kids. Is that right? And he said, yes, that's right. And I said, well, what's it going to be next year? No Jewish kids? No African-American kids? No Hispanic kids? And he said, that's not a fair analogy. I said, but excuse me, but it is. Public education educates the public. 7%, 7 to 10% of the public have learning disabilities. And as a public school teacher, you've got no more right to say in a public forum, I won't deal with this 7% of these kids any more than you've got to stand up and say, I don't want any Jewish kids in my class. So, again, I empathize completely with the caller. It is more work. It is more work. But you know what? And not to get squishy about it, but it's also so extraordinarily rewarding because these kids don't learn. They need to be taught. And if you can teach these kids, man, you can teach anybody. And I say to Main Street teachers, use the experience of working with a learning disabled kid to learn how to become a better teacher.
Isn't that similar to asking an English teacher to teach math, though?
Not really, because, hopefully as teachers, we don't teach math and we don't teach English. We teach children. And these children bring tremendous gifts to the table. And for two or three generations, these kids have been stuck into boiler rooms and, you know, put in the classrooms downstairs or in special schools. We now realize that these kids are more similar to normal kids, if you will, than they are dissimilar. And there's no reason, for instance, if a kid has no disability in math, that he shouldn't be in a regular math class, even though he might have disability in language and needs special ed for language. Time was, if he needed special ed in language, he was in special ed for all of his classes. Well, that's not indicated for some kids. I think there's enough, and I hate to use the term blame, but there's enough blame to go around. I think school systems, the legislators, the unions, none of them realized how big this was going to be and how difficult this was going to be for our friends and colleagues in regular education. And frankly, a very poor job was done preparing regular education teachers for the arrival of special needs kids. It's such a source of inspiration for me, frankly. I'll go all over the country, and again, particularly in your area, on a Saturday, and there'll be 500 teachers there at their own expense to learn how to deal with these kids because they realize, frankly, they're not going anywhere. These kids are going to be in our classes. They also, tongue-in-cheek, suffer from something we refer to as excessive attendance. They're never absent. They're going to be there every day, and teachers are beginning to realize we really need to learn how to deal more effectively with them.
Hmm. I've got a number of other listeners who've called in now. Let's take another call. A listener in Charleston, line 4. Hi.
Yes. I'm on a payphone, so sorry for the noise. But in any case, I'd like to relate my experience as a child. In the public school in junior high, we were in the classroom, four or five of the boys shooting spit wads, you know, which we had been nurtured in that practice by parents. And my father, who was an authoritarian character, you never questioned him. So the teacher caught me, said, you go to the principal's office, and I did. And he came in, acknowledged I was there, and then waited 20 minutes and a piece of paper and a pencil over and said, I want you to write down everybody's name who was doing that. And I look at him, and I see my father, and I say, yes, sir, and I wrote him down and handed it to him. Of course, I don't know whether the other children got in trouble for it, but nevertheless, on my way home, I'm a poor, lower-working-class kid walking, and about a mile from school, half a mile, those 4 to 6 people showed up on their bicycles, which there was the class break. I'm walking there riding. Mm-hmm. And they surrounded me and began hitting me with the bicycle tires and taunting me and all the epithets or name-calling that engendered and created. All I could do was stand there petrified. I never said a word. I never responded in any way, because I knew if I had resisted my father, the beating would have been a lot more severe. So I learned, again, a lesson from the father in this crowd, and so I said nothing. And they, when they realized that I weren't going to take the bait and start a fight, they all went away. And after that, my lesson was that you have no friends, that you trust nobody, that you must make your way somehow through this maze without any help. And there was absolutely no help in those days. I'm talking 1948. Uh-huh. And so I don't think a lot has changed. My own children went through similar sorts of things. I don't think not to that degree. But it was one of those things that school became something I had to endure. And it was, and the lessons I learned from that was that you must be a loner, that if you don't join a group or join a crowd and do all the things they do, the bullying crowd included, or the more benign kids, who there are very few of those. And it was a lesson in life for me when I was 10 years old. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to say those things because I think that it's still pertinent. And then with the LD and such, is, I think, even more stark. And I'll hang up and then I'll listen. Thanks, Celeste.
Okay.
Again, what's missing in that formula is the tremendous laboratory that friendships provide for kids. You know, if you think about when you were a kid, Celeste, going to somebody's house for the Sunday afternoon and playing records and playing Monopoly with another child or two, you learned a tremendous amount about yourself, about social skills, about social competence, how to win, how to lose, how to play fair, how to be gracious. You learned all those things in those laboratories, and if you don't have childhood friendships, you've lost that laboratory.
Let's take another call. A listener on line 2 in Urbana. Hi.
Yes, I'm in need of some advice, actually. As the parent of a child who is entering middle school, the dreaded middle school, and the child has learning disabilities, I think that in order to be successful, or at least attempt to be successful in the social arena, is part of it is educating peers. And I'm wondering what the best way to go about doing that. A couple of my thoughts was to address the student council and possibly the peer mediators. So I was just wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I think that mainstreaming, for all of its faults, and there are certainly some faults to it, one thing it has created is a generation of American children who are extraordinarily tolerant and understanding of exceptionality. When I grew up, I didn't ever know a child in a wheelchair. I knew some children who had exceptional needs because they lived in the community, but they certainly didn't go to school with us. And yet my children have been raised in an environment where they've been around people with special needs, people with physical problems and that kind of thing. You actually can make it a very positive learning experience for the other kids by doing exactly what you said, using the student council, using the peer mediators, using charismatic people in the school to support the special needs kid. One of the best special ed programs I ever saw was in Greenwich, Connecticut, because the person who ran special ed in the high school was also the high school football coach. And he was a very charismatic figure. Everyone in the school adored him. And as a reflection of that, the school was very affectionate and accepting of the special needs children he dealt with. As a matter of fact, if the last thing you'd want to do is bully a special needs kid, because if you did, you'd find some 200-pound linebacker standing behind you and say, hey, nobody messes with the coach's kids. So those kinds of things, getting a charismatic adult in the school, whether it's the principal or a teacher or a coach everybody feels strongly about, to identifying with those special needs kids, that automatically improves the kid's social stock. So, yeah, there's a great deal we can do. And, again, it's going to make a stronger and more accepting generation of kids. In the book, I talk a lot about siblings of special needs kids. And the research shows very clearly that kids who are raised in a family with a special needs child end up, for the most part, being very solid adults who really understand the human condition because they've spent their childhood watching someone have to work twice as hard to get half as far. Yeah. And it really gives them a real edge up in terms of understanding what the human condition is all about.
In the chapter on siblings, there's a very moving afterword that was provided by a woman by the name of Noreen Boyle, who grew up to be a nurse. Mm-hmm. Very quickly, you just want to kind of give us the gist of what she had to say?
I'm glad you picked that out, Celeste. I tried to read that one time in front of a group, and I got halfway through it and couldn't finish it. It's such a beautiful little piece of prose, and it just talks about a girl who's a senior in high school in her bedroom listening to her younger brother in the next room, and every night as he went to sleep, she'd hear him talking out loud to himself, and she'd yell it to the next room, quiet down, until she began to realize what he was doing at the end of every day is walking himself through his day and making things different. You know, I wish the cheerleader had talked to me instead of making fun of me. And he'd kind of walk through his day, this horrible day he had at school, and to kind of get him through and get ready for the next day. And she said once she realized that's what he was doing, she just let him do it and never interrupted him again. It's written far more beautifully than I just did. But it really shows that the siblings of these kids can, again, they develop a real good idea of what it's about. Our three kids, we raised our three kids on the campus of a school for kids with special needs, and every one of them has said, they're all grown now. In fact, one of them's a reporter in the Chicago area. They're all grown and out of the house now, but each of them have said at one time or another that that one of the most important aspects of their upbringing was the fact that they were raised with kids who had to struggle so much, and it gave our kids a much greater appreciation of their gifts by watching these other kids have to work so hard to do things that came so easily to them.
Okay, there we have to leave it. I do want to make one more comment. We had a listener call in who we couldn't get on the air, but she wanted to pass along that she has a daughter who teaches learning disabled kids, and she loves it.
Oh, God bless her. God bless her.
So there we leave it. Rick Lavoie, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon and talking with our listeners.
It was my pleasure.
Richard Lavoie is the author of It's So Much Work to Be Your Friend, Helping the Child with Learning Disabilities Find Social Success. The book is published by Touchstone, a division of Simon & Schuster. There's also a companion video and DVD available from PBS. And you can find our guest on the web at ricklavoie.com, L-A-V-O-I-E. And I mentioned he does a lot of traveling, he does a lot of speaking, a lot of consulting, and you can find his schedule, his tour schedule, and his events on the website, ricklavoie.com. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, you're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Let's find out now what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, a lot riding on what's been happening on the John Deere Pro Farmer Crop Tour at the Board of Trade. We'll have a complete look at those numbers when Dave Dickey reports about them. During the closing market report this afternoon, let me tell you that up front, Pro Farmer in Illinois found a little better crop than USDA had reported in its last August crop production number at 125. The Pro Farmer report at 127, I believe 0.2 bushels the acre for corn. I did take a quick look at what was happening with the Midwestern Regional Climate Center numbers as well. They're now, at last week we told you 140 bushels the acre, they're at 137. That doesn't include insect damage. So the number is getting bigger in Illinois rather than smaller, and that's having an impact in Chicago, down about 2-3 cents in the corn. The bean pod counts were up 2 in Illinois, and that's really pushing the market lower. This is the second time, Dave Dickey tells me, I believe since the 19th, that futures have closed below $6 in the November contract, and they closed below, settled below $6 for the first time today. Now, let me back that up. This is the second time they've been below $6, but the first time they closed below $6, and that happened today in the November contract. The numbers like this from the wheat pit now at the Chicago Board of Trade. Soft red winter wheat had a high today of 3.16 1/4. In the nearby September, the low at 3.10 1/4, settlement price at 3.15 3/4, and they were 1 1/3 cents higher. December futures 3.32, the high, the low at 3.25 1/4, settlement price there at $3.31, up 2.5 cents in the March futures, a 3 cent gain, 3.44 1/2 in the wheat pit for the high, the low at 37 3/4, and the settlement price at $3.44 1/4 a bushel, up 3 for the March contract. May futures next year 3.50 1/2 on the high, the low at 3.48 1/2, a settlement price for the May wheat at 3.50 1/2 from the board. They were up 4 cents. July contract 3.52 1/2, the high, the low at 3.47, a settlement price at 3.52 1/2, and they finished 2.5 cents higher. From the corn pit now, September contract off 2.5 cents today, 2.10 the high, the low at 2.05 1/4, settlement price at 2.06 1/4. Once again, they were off 2.5. Your new crop December, a 2.19 3/4 settlement price, 2.5 cents lower. The high for the December at 2.23 1/2. The low at 2.18 3/4. Again, the settlement price $2.19 3/4 for December corn. It was down 2.5 cents. The March futures 2.33. The high, the low at 2.28 1/2, and a settlement price 2.29 1/2. They were down 2.5 cents for the day. May contract in the corn pit 2.39. The high, the low at 2.34 1/4. A settlement price at 2.35 1/4, off 3 cents. In July futures $2.43¾, the high, the low at $2.39½ a bushel, and the settlement price for the July corn, $2.40½, they were down 2. September futures down 2½, $2.47, the high, the low at 44, settled a half above that at $2.44½ for September 2006 corn contract at the Board of Trade, down 2½ cents. September oats, $1.51¼, the high, the low at $1.48¼, settlement price at $1.50, down 1¼, and December oats down 1 cent, $1.59¼, the settlement price, the high at 60, even the low at 57¼ for the Dease oats. From the soy complex now, September beans, $6, the high price, the low at $5.84½, settlement price at $5.87. They were off 15½ cents today. November futures, $6.10 high, low at $5.95½. And a settlement price there at $5.97¾ for the November beans. They were down 15 cents for the day. January futures off 15½, $6.16 the high, the low at $6.02½, settlement price at $6.04¼. They were off 15½ cents in the March futures, $6.21 the high, the low at $6.09, settlement price at $6.10¾, down 14¾ in the May futures, $6.23 the high, the low at $6.10½. Settlement there at $6.13¼. They were off 12¼ today. July futures in the bean pit, $6.26½. The high, the low at $6.15. The settlement price at $6.16¾. They were down 13¾. Bean meal futures, September futures, $187.50. The high, the low at $182.80. Settlement price at $183.70. They were off $4.60. And the October bean meal, $188.10. The high, the low at $183.20. A settlement price at $184.30. They were off $4.30 today. September bean oil, $22.40 at the board for the high, the low at $21.97, and a $22.06 settlement price off $44 in the October contract for the soybean oil, $22.48 the high, the low at $22.05, settlement price there at $22.15, and they were down $44 once again, the settlement price at $22.15 for that October bean oil contract. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
And livestock prices were higher today on the Merc. August feeder cattle, the high today, $111.37½, the low, $111.25. The settlement, $111.30, that unchanged. September, $110.50, the high, $109.60, the low, $109.95, the settlement, that up 50. October, $109.35, the high, $108.25, the low, the settlement, $108.60, that up 60. August live cattle, $82.40, the high, $81.25, the low, $81.50, the settlement, that up 45. October live cattle, $83.15, the high, $81.80, the low, $82.12½, the settlement, that up 12½. October lean hog, $63.45, the high, $61.95, the low, $63.32½, the settlement, that up 152½. December, $60.70, the high, $59.35, the low, $60.60, the settlement, that up 115. February lean hog, $61.80, the high, $60.60, the low, $61.70, the settlement, that up 85. And April lean hog, $60.80, the high, $60.00, the low, $60.77½, the settlement, that up 65. And August pork bellies finished up 197½. The high was 71.92½. The low 70 even, and August bellies finished at today's high, 71.92½. That up $1.97½. The Dow is up 21 points at 10,456. The Nasdaq up 6 at 21.35. The S&P 500 3 higher at 12.12.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's Ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows...